While philosophers of every kind work to describe the meanings in human life, the final say as to what matters lies in the hands of rather ordinary people who probably are not even aware that they are giving meaning to their lives. These ordinary people generally don't find those meanings in monumental events and phenomena. Oh, sometimes we do look up at the stars, wonder at the model of an atom, think about the evolutionary sweep of life, or ponder the mysteries of death. But mostly, I suspect that meaning comes from little things that are so seemingly insignificant that they make their impact unconsciously. Things like marbles. I dug a hole in the side yard recently. 6 inches down, I turned up a marble, rubbed the dirt from it, and stood looking at it in the palm of my hand. It reminded me of other lost marbles. It reminded me of when marbles were a pocket full of anticipation on a long May afternoon in school. It reminded me of marbles lined up by colors like troops in dress uniforms on a living room floor parade ground. Marbles, each so self-contained and perfect in its shining roundness. Marbles looking good enough to eat. One found marble, a time machine, a touch stone to once, a key to unlock a pleasant part of me. I mailed it to one of my sons, who probably lost it once, so that he too would have it to remember when marbles had meaning. We ought to find such little things that can be strings around our memory's fingers to remind us to revisit the best of our once upon a times. Three little girls climbing the maple tree in my backyard neighbor's backyard, creeping among the branches, hidden by leaves in a world of summer make-believe. I could hear them. "Here comes the wicked witch with horrible teeth and long, scratchy claws," one of them would say, and the others would shriek and clamber to higher or lower branches to escape. Then quiet. And then, "Here comes the terrible monster with red eyes and slimy, drippy fangs." And they would scream and scamper to precarious safety away from the threats of their imaginations. Sometimes we are like those little girls, except they scare themselves for the fun of it, moving easily as children can into that twilight world between reality and superstition, with one foot playfully splashing in the puddles of pretend, while the other stays firmly on the ground of reality. When we do it, we sometimes don't see the distinction and endow our witches and monsters with a semblance of probability. We change the faces of our fears to make them seem probable by giving them last names like old age, disability, lovelessness, aloneness, and so on. And then we give them all the same first name. What if? I think the little girls do a healthier job of scaring themselves. It's very hard for most people of Northern European ancestry to cry, especially men. I don't know why, but it's true. And I am no different from the rest, even though intellectually I know better. The day the dog died proved it. The dog had come to us 15 years before, a wet old stray that had been sleeping in a cardboard box under some bushes. A poor arrangement that concerned kids like my eldest son had fixed up for her during that rainy spring. We had been hearing about this dog for 2 or 3 days before my son decided to bring her home. A soaked, thin, shivering, red and white dog of mixed antecedents with an obvious strain of hound in her. Well, we agreed to let it be an overnight arrangement until we could take her to the animal shelter. After being dried and fed, she proceeded to make an inquiring visit to each member of the family around the living room, and then lay down in the middle of the floor and went to sleep, as if she were home. She was, and we had a dog. The friendliest, most affectionate, people-pleasing dog I've ever known. During her life with us, my sons grew up. I went from my late 30s to my early 50s. Members of our larger families grew old, and some died. My wife and I divorced. The dog seemed to be the only unchanging part of our lives. But nothing living stays unchanged. Finally, the dog grew ill with an illness that was more troublesome than debilitating. And so, against my inclinations, I and the son who had brought her home that day 15 years before took her to the vet's. I held her gently, stroked her, and tried to reassure her while she died. Refusing the vet's offer to dispose of her body for us, I picked her body up, walked out of the office, stood on the vet's front porch while my son went to get the car, and cried harder and longer than I ever remember crying before. As I stood there holding a dead dog in my arms, I realized that I was not only crying for her, for what I felt was the injustice of her death, and for the loss of her, but I was crying for all my losses, for my family grown old or gone, for my young love long past, for my broken marriage and broken history, for all the lost times and things and people and places that I had not cried for before. And I realized we ought to cry more easily and not have to wait for the day the dog dies. Thank God I'm getting older. I say that because I'm not reconciled to the alternative yet. But that good process, aging, is usually accompanied by its shabbier relatives, myopia, bursitis, astigmatism, arthritis, and a bunch of possible others. I was visited by one of that family one morning a few weeks ago and was sitting, having my early morning coffee, visiting with my arthritis, and thinking about my future with that unwelcome guest. That got me thinking about canes. Now, there are several choices. There is the traditional one that always reminds me of a polished wooden question mark. Too ordinary. Then there is the shiny aluminum one that adjusts up and down with the push of a button. Or its high-tech variation, which has several rubber-clad feet that make it look like a long-stemmed spider. Too mechanical. Then there are suave, silver-headed walking sticks, heavy brass cudgels, and wispy bamboo canes that may be fine for wealthy dowagers, garrulous old soldiers, and song and dance men, but not for me. For me, I decided it will have to be one I find in a young maple woods, part of a slim tree where a call has given the young trunk a knob and I can polish it round to fit my hand, or a crook that can be peeled and varnished. I like canes. They represent determination, the rugged determination to keep going. But I want to keep going with a cane I made, like no other. After all, if you have to hobble, do it with individuality and style. I plant several kinds of vegetables, every one because I like it. I like beets and Jerusalem artichokes for their earthy taste, onions, peppers, and garlic for their flavors, potatoes because they're like good old relatives, lettuce for its moist, crispy feel between my teeth, radishes for their impertinence, and so on, from one end of my garden to the other. But corn is different. Oh, I love the taste of it, but it's not its taste I mostly plant it for. It's not even for its tall, strong stalk or its intriguing prop roots that arch out at the bottom of the stalk like flying buttresses. It's for its leaves. It's for the sound they make in the wind. It's for that soft clatter, the rustle, the whisper they make that gives a voice to the garden that nothing else can. I'd plant corn even if it grew no food, just for the sound, which is food to my ears.